Welcome, pudding people, to another episode of Everybody Loves Pudding. I am your host, Ken Seymour. I've got a great one for you today. I just get a little bit giddy anytime I get to speak with anybody involved with live theater in production or basically anywhere. History, now, whatever. It just brings a smile to my face, and I have somebody involved in one of my favorite plays. We have Gisela Adisa joining us today. Thank you so much.
Wow, I had no idea this was your favorite play. That makes me like so excited, but also nervous.
Well, you know,
are you a purist? Are you a musical theater purist?
No, not at all. That we, my co-host and I, often we talk about a lot of movies and a lot of theater and music. And one of the things we often talk about is the cover song in music. You can appreciate a new interpretation and still just love it for what it is, love the original, and just see where the artist has decided to go somewhere a little bit different. It's fun stuff. Even if it's not the way you wanted the original. I love the original of whatever song. Billie Jean, for example. Fantastic song. Chris Cornell puts a spin on it that is just phenomenal. But you still kind of like the original better. So I mean, that doesn't mean anything.
I mean, when you say it's your favorite, I imagine you as like a little kid listening to it, and it's just like hardwired into you. And it's just hard to, when something is revived the way this show has been revived, 1776, that is a concern. Yeah. But hopefully the purists will come to still see the show because they love the show. A lot of people have been in it in like high school or grade school. And so they have, there's a, you know, a heart tie, there's a connection to it. And we don't want to mess with that, but we can't help but be ourselves on that stage. And I don't know if your audience is aware, but this revival of 1776, which is a dramatization of how the Declaration of Independence came to be, it's been recast. So the people playing John Adams don't look like John Adams. The people playing Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin and James Wilson do not look like the historical figures. No. We are an all-female, non-binary and trans cast of people who were assigned female at birth. I happen to be cisgendered, which is just a way of saying I am a woman who was born a woman, and that is my gender as well. And we have many different like ethnicities and religious backgrounds. We have indigenous people, Latina people, Asian people, Black people, white people, but we are all the people who weren't in the room or considered as people in the room where it happened. Mm-hmm. And so we are getting to tell this story. And not only are the songs different, but the energy is different, but it's still a story about America. It's still that.
Oh, I'm going to have so many questions. It's going to be good. But I want to start at the beginning because, you know, every performance is informed by the person doing the performance, and the person doing the performance is informed by their own history. So I always love to know what it is that puts you on the path that you're on now to become a part of theater in general, to be part of this tapestry of storytellers. How did you get started?
Well, I am a first generation American. And the reason why that's important is because you're very much not quite outside, not quite inside. My perspective is very much outside looking in on all of the quirks and idiosyncrasies of American culture, and how they view immigrants, how hard it was for my parents who came from, my mother came from Haiti. She was Haitian and Dominican. My father is from West Africa, specifically Nigeria. They came from two completely different outlooks, ideologies, economic backgrounds. My mother had maids in Haiti. My father did not have maids in Nigeria. He's Muslim. She was Catholic. So we focus more on the commonalities, which were, we speak English, we're living in this country, and we're trying to make it work. And so that's kind of always been my perspective of observing and pointing and noticing the differences, but trying to find a way to also see the commonality, because it's all there at the same time. Just being able to hold space for both things at the same time. Right. But that all being said, they come from these countries where, look, we came here to have you. You're going to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer. Or, and that was kind of the path I was going on. I enjoyed school. I enjoyed biology and science. Didn't enjoy math, but, you know, I did okay in math. It was obsessed with history. And I just had this feeling in my predominantly white institutions. I went to private Catholic girls' school. And you could always pick me out, you know, it's like a raisin in a bowl of oatmeal. So I was very much outside looking in many different ways in that environment, but I just felt like we're not learning everything there is to learn. Like, I didn't know what wasn't there, but I knew there was something missing. So once I got to college, I don't know if you can curse on this, but just for gits and shiggles, I would take classes that I found interesting when I had like some extra credits that I needed to fill. So I would take Alvin Ailey dance class for like 2 credits, where I would take MLK and MX, which was this study of the different ideologies of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and how towards the ends of both their lives, they started to kind of realize you need to hold space for nonviolence, or you need to hold space for sometimes you got to crack some eggs. So I just took these courses because they seemed interesting to me. All the while, by that point, I figured out that I wanted to be an actor. That revelation came late in high school, much to my mother's chagrin. And I auditioned for schools. I got in to a couple of schools and a couple of drama programs, and that was my sign to major in drama. But what happened at the end of my senior year, my penultimate year, I met the bursar, just, you know, trying to deal with my student loans and my little scholarship or whatever. And thank God this woman said this to me. She's an angel. She said, "Huh." I said, "What?" And I'm just dreading, like, please don't tell me I owe more money than I actually do. She said, "You know, if you take one more class, you could have a minor in African studies." And I was like, I can. And that was just from me taking classes, because I just felt like I didn't get any type of lesson in our contribution to making this country. The only stories you got told in my day were Harriet Tubman, and her story is amazing. This woman was like a Union spy. And not only did she save like dozens of people, including her own family members, but she also ended up doing some like Mission Impossible spy stuff, where she ended up saving hundreds of other people. So we learned she did the railroad and that was it. Like, right. We didn't learn any of the other stuff. I had to go to college and pay extra money and end up getting a minor in African studies to learn that. We were always enslaved, but they didn't talk about how we tried to free ourselves. They didn't talk about the abolitionist that looked like everyone, like white abolitionists, black abolitionists, Asian like there were just so much about the fabric of America that these books just seemed to be willfully ignoring. And I jokingly sometimes refer to that scenario as like the benighted states of America, because there's a very specific story and a way that it needs to be told for some people to feel safe and secured and centered in the dogma,
right?
You know, this is how we came to be, manifest destiny. We didn't do anything like, and that's just not the truth. And it's telling the truth doesn't mean that you don't love your country. Telling the truth to me is the true patriotism, because I love you, America. And I want you to look in the mirror, look at yourself, see what didn't quite go the way you think it did, so that it can never happen again and we can be better and stronger.
Yeah.
And that's kind of ultimately why I took this job, because between you and me, I'd never seen 1776 before, not even the film. It wasn't something that was shown to me in school, and it wasn't something I was looking to see. But now that I've, you know, got the job in 2022 to play a much smaller role, to play Robert Livingston, and have gotten to really understand with dramaturgy and researching and just being a part of these amazing talented casts who are also doing their own background work and sharing, I'm just so fascinated by who these men were, just as men. Like, some of them were as young as 28, but running whole plantations and estates, and, you know, they were like the, I don't know, kind of like the crypto geniuses of their time. Like, the idea that you could pull away from the crown, from your mother country,
right,
and make your own country. Like, who does that? So it's been an interesting journey to get here. I never would have thought that I'd be playing John Adams.
Right.
but here we are.
I know, as you mentioned, this is something that's been part of my life from the very beginning. And I had the same education that had certain holes in it at the beginning. You know, you get that footnote of George Washington Carver, and then they'd never talk about him again, you know, things like that. But, you know, watching 1776, and I love the film, it's such a gem. The original run was a gem, but it's idealized, and it's not complete. And only finding that out when you get older is kind of like a bit of a slap in the face.
It hurts. It hurts.
Yeah. But you know, it's important. It's important to know. So was there, you said that you never saw 1776 originally. Was there a single play or film or some piece of a fiction that you were exposed to that was like that lightning in a bottle moment where you go, oh, okay, I get it. This is definitely for me.
Huh. I don't know that there was a specific one, but happy childhood memories include, and looking back and going, that's when it started. They should have known right there. They should have known right there to put me in dance class or to really push the math to get it out of me, to get the love of art out of me. The Muppet Show. The Muppet Show. I don't remember what night it would come on, but it was once a week, and we would all get in front of the, you know, the TV, which was an actual cathode ray tube, you know, like an actual box. And my whole family would sit out there, but not me, not yet. I had to wait for the theme song to come on, and I had to do a specific dance that I, you know, looking back, it's like, I choreographed that. Like, and I did this whole song and dance just to watch it. And I would just feel, I don't know, I just felt good. I just felt like this is who I am. And then I had moments doing high school plays and college plays where I would just look up at the lights and go, I feel like I'm at home, and I feel like this is where I'm going to be for a long time. And I didn't understand that feeling, but looking back, it makes sense now. But as far as like things that I viewed, I loved The Wiz. I think it's called The Return of Oz. Mm-hmm. My mother took me to some beautiful movie theater in New York City. And we would only go to New York City for like special occasions, like go to St. Patrick's for Easter mass. And then we would go ice skating at the Rockefeller Center rink. So New York to me is just like, it was the bee's knees. It was the place where you go for fun. That's all I knew it as. And so we just saw this movie and I just thought, this is so beautiful, but never in my mind's eye did I think I'm going to be up there or I'm going to be. And I think part of that, and part of the reason why maybe I wasn't looking for a show like 1776 is because I didn't see myself in it. I didn't see someone who looked like me. And unfortunately, for many aspects of growing up in this country, if you don't see someone that looks like you, doing the thing, executing the thing, being in the thing, even though it's not explicitly said you don't belong here, it's implied that that's not for you. So I don't think anything in my early years was that moment for me, but the few times when I was on a stage or doing something that felt staged, I definitely felt like, this feels good.
Yeah, that seems to be a prevalent problem in a lot of places. I'm a part of what we do on our podcast is we talk about the intersection of comic strips and comic books and other forms of media. And one of my favorite kind of watershed moments that I saw was the formation of the imprint Milestone for DC. I don't know if you ever heard about that, but it was the first comic book publisher, basically, that was created for stories for immigrants, for people of color, that because, you know, previously, you know, the writers that were making comics didn't have the experience. They didn't understand. What they were writing didn't make any sense. And so several individuals within the industry just kind of came together and said, well, we need to do this. They came up with a whole new coloring system for the comics so that skin tones would be represented more accurately. And it was so cool. And it's one of those things that just, again, that just kind of struck me when I saw it the first time. It's like, man, I need more of stuff like this, because this is what makes things interesting. This is where you get to see actual differences of perspective that is just that you don't get when you're living your own bubble of the same people.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that can be for anyone. You don't have to be black to be enriched by seeing a comic book that has dark skin tones. Just looking at little children when they're playing with dolls, they're not only picking up the white doll, they're picking up the Asian doll, they're picking up the brown doll. To them, they're just dolls, because that construct is something that is slowly put on us. And the beautiful thing about something as, you know, seemingly superficial as a comic book or a musical is art is a part of life, and art often reflects life. And if we're not honest in our art about what life actually looks like, it kind of makes for less space for actual real life human beings to feel like they can enjoy that art or feel seen in that art. And even if you happen to be a white person who's used to, you know, being, you don't realize that you've been centered so long. Not everyone does. But just seeing the shift will feel uncomfortable for some people. And that's going to be hard for some people to wrap their head around. Like, am I feeling that way because I don't like these people, or am I feeling that way for another reason? And I think it's more often than not, it's the other reason of you've been programmed or conditioned to feel that way. And you're not a bad person. It's just, it's like corn syrup, this construct of race and things being classified by the color of your skin, which sounds so ridiculous, but that's, even though it's not a real thing, it's become a reality for everyone in every single aspect. So whether it's musicals or movies or TV shows or even, you know, a commercial for cereal or even, you know, Disney's Ariel, it's anytime something seemingly innocuous comes up and they're like, oh, we've decided to cast someone that, you know, you wouldn't think we would normally cast, the explosive reaction that comes out of that, which is some people being like, yes, and some people being like, no, and getting really angry. It's a symptom of what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
So it's definitely something I've experienced personally, you know. Well, I mean, I don't take it personally because I understand where it's coming from. People's intolerance and hatred has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with them and their inability to realize the conditioning that, you know, their opinions aren't even their own opinions.
Right.
And once I think they learn that, it's almost painful. It's a very painful process. So I'm happy, actually, when I see that is the reaction, because then I know that person is paying attention. It's the beauty of theater. You can see if you cheat and look past the fourth wall, you know, if you look into the audience, you can see some furled lips and you can see some arms crossed, and you might even see someone leave at intermission because they just can't handle the fact that my black butt has been cast as John Adams. We see it in the comments, you know, or just the fact that, you know, if it's not about race, then they'll say, well, Thomas Jefferson wasn't a woman, because it's a woman, Nancy Anderson, expertly playing him. She plays the violin. She's just so talented. Like, there's no other person more deserving for this role. And for people to get caught up in the fact that they don't literally look like these people, but be okay with, say, Cleopatra being played by Elizabeth Taylor, or what was that movie? I think it was Prince of Egypt with Jake Gyllenhaal. Like,
yeah,
you know, and Russell Crowe playing a Spaniard in Gladiator. I mean, those are things that we don't question and we don't get up in arms about. But when the shoe's on the other foot, there's an explosive reaction.
Right.
So I don't know. I take pride in the fact that I'm able to do the job and feel like, besides it being enriching for me personally, hopefully it will encourage people to realize, why do I feel this way?
Yeah. Well, if anything, with the success of plays like Hamilton, shows that you can have an amazing interpretation that strays wildly from the original and it can still be awesome. So let me ask you this question. So you've made your decision. I know I'm going backwards a little bit here too, but this is like one of my absolute favorite questions to ask people that have gone into the industry. You've made the decision to go down the route. You've started training. You're learning your craft. What is one thing that you found in the process of making a stage play or making a television show or a movie that you would never have expected was an important aspect before you got into the side of making things come to life?
Oh, wow. Ooh, that's a good one. Well, I've done mostly theater. I've done a little bit of TV and film. And one aspect, could you ask the last part of it again? What was the
something that you
one aspect that was surprising?
Yeah, something you would not have expected you would have had to think about as a layperson, because, you know, we watch things from the finished side. We get to see the product of all the effort, but there's a lot of behind the scenes things that go into making it that if you go in as an actor, that you may not realize that I had to think about. You know, whether it's just, oh, stage tape. That's important. I would never have expected that.
Well, yeah. As far as TV and film, I've yet to have a role where this is going to be an issue, because I've only ever done like small, like we call them day player roles, where you've got a couple of scenes and they squeeze them all into one day. But I'm 5'3", and some actors are taller. Most people are taller than I am. I'm short. So one thing that I've seen them do on sets, not with me personally, but if you're extremely tall and your scene partner is extremely short and they need you in the same shot, they will build this like set thing of apple boxes for you to walk on next to the person. Or what they used to do, I don't think they do this anymore, they used to dig like a trench for the taller person. They don't do that anymore. I think they're better at like just angles and using stand-ins and stuff. But I always kind of worried, like, oh my God, what if I'm too short? And I just started making like a mental list of actors, like, you know, one day if I'm in like a big blockbuster movie, okay, I can work with Tom Cruise, definitely work with Kevin Hart. I might be taller than Kevin Hart.
Everyone's taller than Kevin Hart.
So there's that. The first tour I did was Sister Act, and this shocked me. I was like, what kind of tour? I was backstage. What kind of job am I on that they need condoms and Smirnoff vodka or some other like basement level, shelf level vodka what is this shipment for? And then I learned that they take the mic packs, like the little square bit that ties to the actual mic, which goes around, you know, your head. They wrap the mic pack in a condom because it's waterproof. And it's a tight, perfect seal, and it's just cheaper than buying something specifically meant for the mic pack. Then they slip that in, you know, you have like a little mic belt, or like I'll wear it on my bra, wherever. And the Smirnoff, or the like whatever the lowest rung of quality in vodka, they put it in spray bottles with I think it's like half water, it's like equal parts water and vodka, and they spray down the costumes in between, and it keeps them deodorized and kind of sanitized. So
and delicious.
That was like an interesting tip. I was relieved, and I was like, okay, just making sure I didn't get caught up in something that I don't want to get caught up in. So it's just little things like that. Anything else that I would share? I wouldn't want to tell your audience how the sausage is made and like ruin it for them, but there's a lot of stuff that directors do want to set if it's an outdoor scene, and where that sun is really important, and it changes everything. And you can see a scene that looked like it took takes 2 minutes, but maybe they shot it for the better part of half a day because they were outside and dealing with planes flying over and waiting, or, you know, people watching and making noise. So they will have like all these cool reflectors and different lights to try to balance it out and make it all look like it all happened in the same moment. And then even after that, they will color correct digitally. So yeah, it's all fascinating. Every time I'm on a movie set or a TV set, I learn so much more about all the work it takes, all the different people it takes just to make, you know, even a 22-minute TV show. And that may seem unimportant to some people. The arts may seem unimportant to some people, but when the pandemic happened, the arts kept me sane, because I would just binge watch everything on, you know, all these streaming sites, and, you know, I would listen to music, and yeah. The arts are a lifesaver. We need them.
Oh, I definitely agree. I've made this argument many times that I would argue that the arts are potentially almost more important than certain aspects. I mean, yes, sciences are important in terms of what we're going to be able to do with our lives, but the arts are about how we live our lives. And without mm-hmm. that, it doesn't matter anymore. What's the point mm-hmm. of being able to live an extra 50 years if your soul is barren?
Yeah.
But
I like to say that thanks to science and all the other industries, we are amazing Homo sapiens. But thanks to the arts, we are human beings.
Yeah.
It's just different. It's that connection of your, some people call it soul or spirit, that we could all be watching the same thing and feel the same emotion, even though we're total strangers sitting in the dark in a room, whether it's a movie theater or, you know, a friend's basement or the Amundsen Theater where we currently are in LA. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's also really kind of fun to see. One of the things that I love about whether it's theater or television or film is seeing interactions between the people on screen, because no matter what, yes, you're playing this other person, there's going to be a little bit of you, sometimes a lot of bit of you, depending upon who you are, that's going to come through on it. And seeing that interaction with other people of just immense talent is so much fun, which kind of leads me to my next question. You've had the opportunity to work with some very impressively talented people in the productions that you've had so far. I wanted to ask you about one of them in particular, because I'm a huge fan of heist films and heist television shows. And so when I saw that you got to be a part of Kaleidoscope, did you get a chance to have any scenes with Giancarlo Esposito?
No, I didn't. And I was just, so heartbroken. I did a scene with Paz Vega and Rufus Sewell, who were very kind, very generous, very tolerant of, you know, working with this little nobody. But no, I didn't get to meet him. And the nature of, and the one time when you would, as a co-star, which is a fancy word for you have one scene or two scenes or under five lines, usually the one chance you get to meet these people might be the table read, which back in the day was in person, but thanks to, you know, the past 3 years, it was virtual, and which is actually a plus because some people were in LA, some people were in New York, some people in Chicago, but we were all together on Zoom and I got to see him there. And I don't mean to like blow up his spot, but he's in, like, just from the little square, the little rectangle, I just think he's just probably the most wonderful human. He was apologizing profusely because he didn't quite have his script on the right spot. And he was like, I'm so sorry, I'm slowing us. I was like, you were a star, shut up. Like, don't worry about it. So I didn't get to meet him, but I have a feeling he's an amazing human. I had the fortune of working with Mario Van Peebles on Raising Kanan. He was a director. And it was, you know, I really had to be like, stop looking at his dreamy face and just listen to what he wants. Don't be crazy. You want to come back. So I'm sure he was like, why is she looking at me like that? It's because I'm in love with you. He's such a handsome man. He was lovely. I got to work with Dulé Hill. I don't know if you ever watched Psych or Suits or West Wing. And right now he's in the talk about recasting in an amazing way. He's in The Wonder Years. Right now, playing the father figure.
That's hard to believe. I can't see him as a father. He's still too young in my mind to be that.
But he actually is a father. He and his wife Jasmine have this beautiful little boy named Levi, and he's so cute. But anyway, so Dulé for me was the first time working with someone who has been in the business forever and was a great model for God, because he is still the humble guy from New Jersey, who just loved tap dancing, loved performing, no matter what it was, whether it was a huge TV show or, you know, a 3 month gig at the Geffen, which is what we did when we were in Lights Out, Nat King Cole.
Oh yeah, I'm going to ask some questions about that.
Oh, he was so great. He played Nat King Cole. He's amazing. And I got to play Eartha Kitt opposite him, but just seeing how he was set my mind at ease. That you hear these stories about successful people being just the worst, and I think those people probably always were the worst, and they let the success unmask them. And I think in the case of Dulé, he was always a good person, and he didn't let the success trick him into any type of false airs. And so that was a great model. If I ever have a fraction of, you know, the success that he has, I'm going to hold on to that for sure.
So I have to ask, that's actually, in fact, going to be my next thing I wanted to know about. Now, the list says that you've got to be both Eartha Kitt and Natalie Cole in that. And those are just two titans of talent. And I just had to know, it's like, how do you approach portraying two individuals that are just so much larger than life in a production? How do you just do that? How do you emote that kind of just magnetism, I guess?
Well, I would like to say you don't think about it so that you stay out of your head. But what I do at first is I think a lot about it so that eventually I don't have to think about it. So the muscle memory is there. I did a lot of research on Eartha Kitt, watched a lot of videos, watched her films, the way she moved, the way she talked, you know, worked on my, definitely worked on that, had to throw that in there. And Natalie, I was playing, the show was such a fever dream, like literally, that we were all in Nat's head, all in Nat King Cole's head. And I like to always use psychology, just basic, either Freudian, Jungian psychology and say, well, when you're in some, when you are imagining something, like when you have a dream, Ken, and I'm in your dream saying some crazy stuff to you, or some, you know, someone you know, that's actually a part of you manifesting looking like me, if you follow certain psychological theories. So I kind of let go of this obsession of I have to be exactly like Eartha Kitt and I have to be exactly like Natalie, because it's actually more complicated. It was Nat's idea of Eartha, which sometimes could be heightened and very sexual, because there was definitely some tension there. And Nat's wife was definitely like, hi, Eartha. Yeah, you can stay over there. You can keep your little gifts and stay over there. And Natalie was his little baby girl. And in the scene with Nat, I got to sing Unforgettable with Dulé. But I was the 15-year-old Natalie. And then throughout the one song, growing into the adult Natalie, which is just... So I just said, you know what? I'm just going to not be myself, but just sing this song and be present with Dulé and just think of him as my father. And hopefully it will be believable, because to change, you know, to quick change from Eartha, red lipstick, you know, vixen, and then to be this little girl, it was, in a perfect world that would have been played by another person, basically. But for the sake of, the economy and keeping the cast tight, I was allowed to play that role, but maybe it should have been played by an actual 15-year-old. I don't know, but it was an amazing experience. And I'm just so glad that I got to do it and sing that song.
That's too cool. That kind of speaks to the number of skills that any actor has to acquire over time. Mm-hmm. And looking at your list of attributed skills, when I was doing a little digging, I had to ask, have you been requested to show some proof of your equestrian abilities for any part thus far?
Yes. Okay. So I'm sure you've heard, especially in the past, maybe not so much now because stuff is traceable and trackable, that a lot of actors were really good for fibbing on their resumes. I didn't fib on my resume, but what I did was I saw this ad for student film called Ride by Night. And they were looking for a woman to play Martha, who was a runaway enslaved woman, who finds help with a white woman who's the widow of a white abolitionist and who agrees to basically shepherd Martha from, you know, the place that she escaped to find her family. And we shot in Montana, and it was like a week long thing. It was for student film. It was really elaborate. The director is Zach Baum. It was like a $20,000 budget, which that just sounds like a lot of money to me for a student film, but NYU, I don't know. So I guess when I submitted my headshot and resume for it, I was like, yeah, I ride horses. I wrote the first and last time I rode a horse was when I was like a kid and someone like put me up on it. Like lies. But once I got the audition and once I got the job offer, I was like, oh damn. Okay. And I just booked myself some equestrian lessons at a stable. I was living in New York at the time. The stable was in the Bronx, believe it or not. And I just took lessons for like a week straight, which is not enough. It's not enough. And I felt really good that I learned how to ride English. Felt really good and got on that plane to Montana. And they're like, okay, we're riding Western. What does that mean? The only difference that I could see with my neophyte eyes was instead of holding the reins like one in each hand, you cross one and you hold it in one hand. You hold at the X of the crossed reins, you hold it and you steer that way. And let me tell you something, my horse Rico, that horse knew. Oh, we're going to have some fun, Gisella.
I was going to say, did the horse take advantage a little bit?
You know, horses are very intuitive, and I think they're just good readers of people. And I knew that. So I was like, you're not going to get scared for me. You're not going to get nervous for me. And I made friends with him, but he didn't understand that when the director said action, I would have to like pull him away from what he was doing, which is usually eating all the grass, and get him to go. And this is what this horse would do to me. And I'll have to describe it because this is a podcast. He would crane his neck up with one salty eyeball and just look at me and then proceed to go in the opposite direction of what I was asking. And just be an all around, you know, smart ass. So when the director would yell cut, I would get off and like talk to him and brush him and like literally grab grass and feed it to him. And then after that, he was like, okay, we're cool. We're friends. But yeah, it was quite the experience. And I love horseback riding. I do. It's just, unfortunately, it's kind of difficult when you're living in a city to find access to it that's not an arm and a leg.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a little pricey.
Yes. It should be, because they need to take care of those horses.
Right, right. The other thing is, you're looking at the accents. I saw one was BBC English accent. Is that an English accent doing the news?
Maybe I meant to put RP, but I don't really do RP because... I mean, I could learn it, but realistically speaking, unless I'm doing voiceover, most in my experience, my friends that are UK Black are the ones that are from African countries or their first generation. There's a very specific accent. It's not Cockney. No. It's not RP. It's like every little region has their very specific way of the sing-song way of speaking. And so I think I just generically put BBC for, because I could easily just watch that and pick it up. But look, for instance, in 1776, I am myself playing John Adams. We are all ourselves doing this idea of what we think these people were. So that kind of freed me from, well, what did they sound like in the 1700s? Probably a mix of, you know, the Irish accent, the German accent from the servants, probably some British, because there were definitely people still fresh from leaving the crown, or they were raised by people who were British. So there was still an affectation. So the way that I've played it is there's a slight British affectation. Some people might even call it mid-Atlantic, you know, that nondescript old-timey movie accent. I think it's a bit more British than that, but yeah, I didn't hone in, because we're not literally being these people. It's very Brechtian. It's the audience is aware from the start of the show. Hi, I'm a Black woman. Mm-mm. I'm about to literally step into these period shoes and put on this jacket and tell you what I think of how, you know, this came to be. I'm going to be John Adams. These people are going to be. And through exposition in the first act, they, you know, they figure it out. It's not explicitly said that way, but, you know, the audience is quick to understand. And I'm glad that our creative team trusts the audience to do that. Not everyone needs everything spoon-fed to them, but the information is fully accessible from the start of the show. And if you're not too quick, it's okay. You'll figure it out by the end of Act One that we are a little bit of ourselves. So the accent thing, I'm going to have to look at that, look at my resume and update it and put specific neighborhoods now that I know them, and not just like, what would I say for American, I speak NBC. I'm like, that's silly.
I speak Midwestern American.
Yeah, which is also a huge place. Yeah. Like, it's a huge place.
So that jacket you spoke of, is that very sparkly studded jacket I got to see the picture of on Instagram?
Sparkly and studded. Mine is my John Adams jacket is this black material with these little white.
Right.
flex on it. Yeah.
That is a gorgeous. That is a gorgeous coat. Is the approach to all of the wardrobe in this version of 1776 kind of that level, kind of a step up in style?
I would say so. The award winning costume designer Emilio Sosa did some really strong research. I happen to be a woman, but he made sure that the silhouette of the jackets is still the way the silhouette was back then, as far as the cut for men. And he did research into what materials would have been more likely used from one region to another. I think my jacket is nice, but the fact that it's dark is very like New England. Some people have a more Puritan type material. It almost looks like felt, and it's a very dark, sedate maroon or deep hunter green for the North, for like New England. And then for the South, since well-off merchants and plantation owners were doing a lot of trade with Asia. So they were getting beautiful Persian silks and brocades and all these patterns. So that's what their jackets look like. And there's amazing, thoughtful trim. It all looks spectacular, but the research behind it is also spectacular.
That's some of the best flavor. As one of the things I love about, good life theater is there are so many elements that go into it that just contribute to helping to immerse you into where you're supposed to be.
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
and you don't even have to know, you don't need to know all of that history, but you watch it and it feels real because someone did the work.
Where does this production deviate from the original? What is, if there was a mission statement, let's say, in putting this particular production of 1776, how would you encapsulate that?
Personally, my mission statement for it is to, like I said before, step into the shoes of this man and to show the audience. And again, this was written by people who are no longer with us, and their estate was very good at letting us know which parts were safe to, okay, we're going to omit this for time because it was a 3-hour musical.
Oh, yeah.
But we're going to insert this letter from Abigail because this makes sense and brings forth ideas of feminism and, equal, the fact that women were a part of making this too in their own way, even though they weren't allowed in the room. I think for me personally, I want you to understand that I know the story, but this is what it feels like for me. There are moments on the stage where I am more Gisella than I am John Adams. And it's on purpose so that the audience can understand this is how I view this story. This is how this part of the story makes me feel. When Thomas Jefferson has to compromise and remove a particular clause out of the Declaration, while it may have been upsetting for the historical John Adams, for me, every slash of that pen across that document feels like a whip. I feel all my ancestors' pain in that moment. And it's not uncommon for me to shed tears in that moment. And maybe to some audience members, it looks like, oh, John Adams was a liberal and didn't believe in slavery, which to some extent is true. But what also is true is his household rented enslaved people from people who own them. So there's a whole complicated, it's not black and white, pun intended. But for me, I know for me, and I know for other people in that audience, they understand what's happening and they are feeling what I'm feeling. And for me, that's my mission statement. I want people who never would look at me and even consider my feelings to be there with me feeling it. And maybe this is just too Pollyanna, but maybe the next time they see someone who looks like me, they'll be able to empathize with that person as well. That's my mission with it. And even though it has nothing to do with the story of 1776, we need to take something that's considered dogma And just by putting our bodies in it, even if we did it verbatim, it's going to look and feel different for everyone. And hopefully we'll go with them.
I like it. What was your, or it's still going, what is your favorite part of the production? Is there a specific monologue or a specific song that every time you get to it, it's like, oh, it's time. This is the bit that I love the best. What's your favorite?
Oh, I would have to say singing Is Anybody There? Because of the words, but more importantly, because it's the one moment conceptually where that membrane between John Adams and Gisela Edisa gets thinner and thinner, and I get to actually finally break through it and look at the audience and say, does anybody see what I see? In my voice, not the slightly British affected John Adams voice. And sometimes you can literally feel the audience go, oh. Like you can just feel it. Sometimes you can hear it too. You know, sometimes you hear people be like, yes, you know, but that's a favorite moment for me.
Yeah, while I've had limited personal experience in theater, those are always my favorite parts, is seeing the reactions of people whenever something particularly that was intended to have, okay, here's the part where you're supposed to have some sort of reaction, and then seeing the reactions like, oh, it's great, as opposed to the reaction should be here, and then crickets. It's like, yeah. Oh,
well,
no.
That's not fun. That's not fun, for sure.
No. So, okay, speaking about the songs, you know, you said a lot of them were changed for the new production. Tell me that at least... at least Sit Down, John State.
Yes. Well, when I say things have changed, I know I'm like scaring the purist in you. When I say things have changed, I mean, just by the fact that we have different vocal ranges and the vocal arrangements were expertly done. Tom Clancy completely like rockified, like The Egg is a straight up banger. How we haven't recorded a cast album is beyond me, because the woman singing Mama Look Sharp is Brooke Simpson, who was a finalist, I think, on America's Got Talent, The Voice. Where that number goes sonically is just, it's a showstopper. She's got the best voice in the whole show. And I'm so glad that they were able to, with the blessing of the estate of the creators, that they were able to rearrange things and transpose, I guess would be the word. So Sit Down, John is still there. It still sounds like what you think, but it's in a different key. Everything is still there. You're going to recognize everything. You're going to love everything. It's just things are in different keys and being sung with different voices that have a different movement, different colors.
Well, let's go historical for a minute.
Yeah.
Now, this play has had multiple iterations. Do you have, in the part that you're playing, do you have a favorite person that performed it previously, whether it be William Daniels from the 69 version, Brent Spiner from 1997, Santino Fontana in 2016? Who have you seen? I assume that you probably have at least seen a few of those. Who's your favorite pre-you version of the Adams character?
Well, like I said before, I didn't look at any of the material simply because, I know that sounds sacrilegious, but simply because I wasn't raised with it. But once I got the audition, I listened to William Daniels. I haven't seen any of the other material. I listened to Molasses to Rum to Slaves. That song in and of itself, I don't recall the actor who played Rutledge in the film, but that song made me realize, oh, I need to take this audition seriously. Even if I'm not the role singing that, like this is a show that has that song in it that is literally going, look at this. Yeah. Look at this hypocrisy. Okay. I have chills right now thinking of it. So But even at this point, because I just didn't want to get other people's
spin
version in my head and think I had to compare and play off of that. So normally that would have been the way to go, like I did with Eartha and Natalie, like looking up stuff and you're just like cyber stalking these people. But because with this concept, we actually get to hold on to more of ourselves, a heightened version of ourselves, and alongside the character we're playing, I didn't do that. But when all is said and done and my time with this tour is over, I'm definitely looking up everything and just watching and listening.
I want you to do something very specific, just for my own personal amusement.
Sure.
If you do end up getting to see the 1997 version, before you watch that, just watch any episode of Star Trek Next Generation to see him as Data first, and then try not to see Data being John Adams.
Oh my God, that's right. Data. Oh, I could totally see him as John Adams.
Yeah, it's so much fun. Oh, because
you know what's funny?
No, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. You know what's funny about there was a revival in the 90s. Is that what you're referring to?
Mm-hmm.
The Broadway revival?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Carol Lee Carmello was Abigail Adams.
Yes.
In that.
Yes.
And then in our final Broadway iteration of this, she played John Dickinson.
How did I miss that?
Isn't that cool?
That is so cool.
Like, I'm trying to wrap my brain around. Imagine being in that show, which for a woman, there's only two roles. You're either playing the wife of John Adams or the wife of Thomas Jefferson. You're either playing Martha or Abigail. And then, you know, 20 or so years later, you're playing John Dickinson. The arts are amazing. They're just amazing.
That's too cool.
Yeah.
Well, what I would like to know next, and this is maybe the most important question that I will ask for our listeners that would like to keep up with what you're doing on any particular day, your next production, your next cool thing, what are the best social media ways to follow you?
Oh, okay. Well, probably Instagram. I have an account at I am Gisella, so letter I, letter M, Gisela. There's also a backup account with my first and last name, but I really don't post much on that. And that's pretty much it. I mean, I'm on Twitter, but I forget to use it. And quite frankly, I may be deleting it pretty soon. It's not what it was. And I think I'm on Facebook, but really the one that I post the most on is Instagram. So feel free to follow me there and look through my stories. A lot of what I've learned over the years, having that minor in African studies, I will share in my stories. And then a lot of what I post on the grid is just, look at me being an actor, you know, the show-offy stuff that casting directors and directors see. But my story is straight up African studies, Pan-African studies, American history, world history, things that show as minor as like people being upset about a little black girl in a Cheerios ad to what's going on, you know, in Sudan. So, mm-hmm. And then I'll give people a break. I'll be like, here's a little baby saying hi for the first time, you know, just kind of in my mind of the things that I see, the way I see them. And it's mostly reposts of other people who have taken the time to collect actual factual data and share it to try to open people's minds.
It's important to take every opportunity to disseminate facts and let people be able to see the world as the way it is. All
yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Palate cleanser. We have a final palate cleansing question.
Yeah.
We like to ask every one of our guests that we remember to ask this question to. Are you a pizza person? And if you are, what kind of a pizza person are you? Are you a Chicago deep dish? Are you a New York slice? Are you a California? What do you love?
Of course I'm a pizza person. Who isn't?
You'd be surprised.
Are you not a
No, God. No, I love pizza, but I've found a lot of people that are not.
I love pizza. I love pizza a little too much. I have traveled a lot. I live in New York. We were in Chicago. I had the deep dish. It's not bad. Don't tell the New Yorkers I said that. It's just a different vibe there. It depends on my mood. Like, if I want that like sandy bottom thin 99 cent, sometimes you're just in the mood for that. It's not the greatest in the world, but it's not bad. I'll even eat a Domino's pizza, like the thin one, which I know that's
They're not
for some
bad.
people, it's just like, what is that? That's not pizza. But pizza from Italy, it's pretty darn good too, although it's
Yeah.
completely different from American pizza. But
Yes,
yeah,
it
I would
is.
say pepperoni. I love pepperoni. And I love a Hawaiian. Sorry, I put pineapple on my pizza. That's me.
Hey, food is food. I love a little something different. Keeps life interesting.
That's right.
Well, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to talk with us today and to let us know a little bit about this most current version of a fantastic musical that has always been a large part of my love of musical theater. And I wish you the best and hope you continue to have success with this. And when you have another really cool project you're involved with, I would love for you to come back and talk with us again.
I would love that, Ken. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time.
All right, thanks.